Adolf Eichmann was being tried in Jerusalem. Eichmann understood and recognized as the chief architect of the Holocaust. And he looked to one, in particular, to one account of Eichmann's trial by Hannah Arendt, in which she observed that whereas previously psychiatrists had imagined that because he was, if you like, guilty of, had been such a massive perpetrator of such a massively scaled atrocity, that Eichmann must be a perverted, sadistic, deeply pathological individual. But what Arendt observed was that actually Eichmann came across as a thoroughly normal, effectively uninspiring career civil servant. And she argued that he'd done what he had done simply because he had been asked to do so. And he had responded to his instructions, his orders, mechanically, unimaginatively, unquestioningly.
Hello, 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 and welcome everybody to another episode of Real Talk Extra. And if you're just listening for the first time on Real Talk Extra, we just have candid conversations about movies that have been made, about real events, real characters, and basically conversations that can be sparked by societal events that have been made into films in the past. We have talked about a lot of films in the past, and we talk about, you know, sometimes we could talk about laissez-faire films, you know, basic topics, and sometimes we move into deep topics. But today we are going to talk about something that comes closer to home, and it actually will deal with what we think about ourselves, our capacity to, you know, make choices, and are we in control of these choices. The name of the movie that actually brings this to light is Experimenta, and Experimenta is a 2015 movie. It's basically the story of Stanley Milgram's experiment. Anybody who is familiar with any form of psychology, you might have come across that name. And it's a film directed by Michael Almeria, and it stars Peter Sarsgaard, Winona Ryder, as well as Jim Gaffigan, amongst others. And with me today, I have Onyeka Onyekpe. How you doing, Onyeka?
Hi, everybody. How are you doing?
And I have Stanley Agu. How you doing, Stan?
Yes, I'm good. Hi, everybody. It's good to have me here today.
First of all, I want to start with, you know, I always have this idea that when something is made into a movie, I've said this 100 times, that it's not just going to be deep, deep scientific experiments. It's something that they want an audience to watch and have certain kinds of knowledge so that we can learn something from it. And one of the things I seem to think about this movie, The Experimenta, it just talks about Stanley Milgram's experiment. And I think the shock experiment primarily walks us through a situation where Stanley Milgram carries out an experiment between the teacher and his subject where shocks are actually administered on the subject. Onyeka, you think you can just give a rundown or a summary of that particular experiment itself?
The experiments were carried out by assistant professor at the time, Milgram, and he wanted to see how subjects reacted to inflicting should I use the word pain on others to find out whether they will conform to authority or not. That's just a basic premise. There were two presumed subjects for the experiments, a teacher and someone who would, like a student who would learn. There was a teacher's job to list out a series of, you know, word associations, and if the student got it wrong, it was the teacher's prerogative to punish the students. And the punishment was done by using what seemed to be an electric shock machine to deliver shocks in increasing doses to the person at the other end. And the experiment basically recorded the findings, and they were quite interesting for the psychological world at the time.
Stanley, what was your take on the significance of this kind of experiment, actually? Like,
Stanley Milgram actually is a social psychologist, so he was trying to test the relationship between, of course, authority and obedience, and where people in authority can compel you to do something that is against human nature. So he was trying to test that relationship, because remember, after the fall of the Reichstag, you now had a lot of all these perpetrators that helped Hitler to perpetrate all the evils were on the run. So when they caught most of them, of course, they were facing trial, just like the one they did with the guy they caught up in Argentina, I think. Adolf, what is his name?
Eichmann.
So Eichmann, so that was the experiment he was looking at in terms of, yes, most of them felt that they were compelled because they were under authority. And we've seen this happen in a lot of dictatorship regimes, where people do the biddings of the leader who is the dictator. And why are people so subjective to that kind of treatment, whereby they fall victim to these leaders and perpetrate all their evil acts? So, but then his whole experiment was to just show that relationship. And in that experiment, we kind of found out that even, when that issue happened regarding the evils of the Nazis, a lot of people felt, oh, I can't do that. I can't beat this. That's evil. But his experiment kind of exposed the fact that the guy next door can do the same evil as well if compelled to do that. So the experiment kind of exposed the fact that you could be compelled to do that if you're not paying attention.
I literally Googled how many volts do you need to shock a human being to death? And what returned to me on a Wikipedia page, which is just, the basic that will just return at the top of a Google search engine, it came between the neighborhoods of, if I do remember, I never saw a 2 in front of it, meaning it came between the neighborhood of 100 and maybe 120 volts or 150 volts thereabouts, but I never saw a 2, meaning it never got to like 200 volts. And in this experiment, we see a situation where Stanley Milgram sets up a scenario where you can shock somebody up to the level of 450. We're talking like, okay, his experiment, the findings came out that we have at least a larger number of people over, like, was it a 60 percentile?
Or 65. More?
65% shocking people and getting to the 450 button. Now, I also noticed that, he would first of all give you a taste of the shock so that you feel the pain. And, that idea of giving you that shock so that you actually know what you're doing to somebody else. But you find that more people actually went to the extreme. And sometimes I come to the point where I actually try to process this kind of thing in a certain kind of way. For those of us who were, raised, going to church, and you tell people that God destroyed the world because he came to the point where he felt that man was desperately wicked, so to speak. And then you look at this experiment in society and you ask yourself that, is it that we are innately wicked, or is it just that we just, the choices actually can be manipulated, or it's in us and we kind of can bring it out under certain kind of circumstances?
Well, personally, from my own little experience, I believe that man has equal parts of evil and good within them. And based on the experiences, based on what they have been taught, based on how the principles they decided to adhere to, they now decide which side to lean towards. For example, there's this saying that if you see someone drowning, will you save between your mom and between your wife? All those sorts of, thought experiments and things like that are just a way of showing people that when the going gets tough, it's very possible for you to take a decision that is that doesn't look normal or seems to be wicked. We see TV programs like Walking Dead and all these other things, and you see the way people respond in terms of crisis. I mean, even from the riots that happened in America recently, the Black Lives Matter riots and all those related things and protests, we saw that in some cases, some people forgot about the fact that they were being killed by policemen and decided to loot department stores. When we come to Nigeria too, we had a similar experience. people forgot that police were killing them and decided to burn down shops and loot places like ShopRite and Co. It's going on in South Africa at the moment at the same time. So you see that people always have the capacity to make bad, almost outrightly evil decisions. It's whether they have the incentive to do it or whether they feel they can get away with it that matters. And so the whole concept of good and evil is a very fluid one. I actually believe that most people can be good when they need to be, or they can be evil if they feel they can get away with being evil.
As far as this movie goes, after, you know, Stanley Milgram carries out this research and everything, he comes out and we notice a pattern where the way it is presented in the film, you know, they juxtapose it between the Eichmann trials and they bring it back, you know, to the experiments and, you know, interweaving how he met his wife in the elevator and all of that good stuff. He comes up with this two basic theories, which he talks about the autonomous states, basically where people actually have power to choose their own actions. And then he kind of brings out something like you would see that towards the end of the movie, he refers to as the agentic state. And that agentic state basically is where he says that, you know, you have the power to choose, but when you choose, you cannot, you actually lack the power to return back to your final position to say, no, I don't want to do this. Now, I ask this because of this whole Nuremberg trials and everything. From your own opinion, are you trying to, do you think that all these people who gassed all these people in the gas chambers and everything, they do not have any kind of like responsibility? It was just all about Hitler or all that, that maybe they slipped into this agentic state?
Yes, they do have this responsibility. And I think, how do we prevent this kind of heinous crime from happening? That's the question we need to look at, because this has happened and has happened in history. We've had this kind of genocide, massacres that happened. The leader is actually in his palace, really, if you look at it. And yeah, he has
drinking beer.
The agents who are carrying out this. So you now say, it's not the leader killing, but people doing it on behalf. And that's how it happens. But then, I would like to say in the area of empathy, you see, and empathy is a very strong emotional intelligence skill. When you talk about empathy, you talk about being in someone's shoes and feeling the pain and everything that individual is going through. It's a human nature. But when we talk about empathy, like Onyeka mentioned, humans have good and bad in them. It resides in us. But when you are good, you can still be good and not have empathy. You just be a bystander. Mm-hmm. And that is another problem we're having now. The bystanders.
Yeah.
Who just don't do anything. They watch what is going on. And we saw what happened to George Floyd, especially just videoing what happened. Took that video, the person videoing, to not be a bystander. And that evidence became very critical in that case. So we need not to be bystanders. But then, if you're not going to be a bystander, then how do you increase your empathy proficiency, the degree at which you can always be in someone's shoes? Remember, in as much as we want to paint the German, the Nazis black, there were some very good Germans that also showed very high level of empathy. We watched the Schindler's List. List, how Schindler was able to buy some Jews and save them from, you know, being gas chambered in that at the Auschwitz. So it means that you, as a human being, what it did demonstrate, the experiment, is that a lot of people were very low on empathy, and they didn't realize that they were low on that empathy. And empathy is something you train yourself to get better at. Even as a leader, you keep on getting better, keep on looking at the fact that you need to be someone that should not just to sympathize, but to empathize with people. So I think if people can empathize, then they can break through that chain. Because even in the experiment, there were some people that said, look, I can't go on with this. I'm killing someone here. And person, but you're in this person, bust this experiment, I'm out of here. So that person already feels that empathy and said, no, I can't do this. So,
but I'm looking at it on the level of, you know, like, you know, when you assume the role, you know, like when he says like the agentic state, he categorized it like people who said, I just work here. This is what we do. this is what we, you know, I'm thinking about. And his findings is that once you assume that role, you know, like you say, okay, now I want to sign up to be a Nazi German soldier, just a typical example, and you sign up into Hitler's army. If I sign up to Hitler's army now, and they send me as my job, he is alluding that you do not have the power. You kind of like the agentic stage, you know, that obedience experiment, people allow that direction to flow, and whatever is said, you know, the typical, hey, I just work here.
From what he said about the agentic states is the states when you abdicate authority to the outcome of, you know, an action you take. And I think in most cases, for example, like in the Hitler's cases, or what you see in, for example, Mauro, the hive mind takes over. That's a situation where everybody is almost acting in unison. Because every other person is doing it, you go ahead with it. You suspend your own ability to think through a situation. In the experiments, the obedience experiments, we're lucky enough to get 35% people that said no, because to a large extent, they weren't influenced by other people beyond the sole authority figure. But when you have authority, when it's expanded and you're in a group, for example, it gets much harder for people to turn back and say no, which is why genocide is so destructive. Because the thing about genocide is it's not a single person going to kill one person. It's a group of people all moving, you know, with camera D and singing and shouting and killing. And then at that time, people's brains sort of shut off. You know, you forget that this is a pregnant woman with a child. You forget that this might be your neighbor that you used to hang out with. You know, people forget so many things. People suspend their ability to reason. And, you know, they shut down empathy. So I agree a lot with what Stan is saying. Empathy is the major thing. But I think when people are in groups or where there's a much higher authority that they defer to, they shut it down for whatever reason. And that's where the agentic state comes in.
Just to add to what we're all saying, when we look at, like you said, when a leader wants to take over you in the agency state, they attack you through the emotional states. That's the only way they can get you. They know that in reasoning, they won't want to reason with you, so they don't go there. So they go through the emotional appeal. Hitler was able to emotionally get the Germans to believe in this dream. And once you can get someone there, then the brain is working, actually, because the area of the brain that handles emotion, which is the amygdala, is still there. But it's just your ability to make a decision to reason, which is your prefrontal cortex is not activated. And that moment, you've entered into that zoning. You could be a puppet or a zombie at that moment because you can just be directed because you can't reason. So that also shows that we have to look at how we bring in the role of reasoning into our discussions, especially how we think, because we saw this happen in America last year, where some people did not reason and they went with their emotions and also attacked the Capitol. So it's something that we have to pay attention to seriously.
A very scary aspect of this thing for me is, you know, after he carried out the experiments, and it's also depicted in this film, because there are a lot of things about Stanley Milgram's research that was not actually put in there. You can't squeeze it into a 1.5 hour flick or 2 hour flick. So after the whole experiments, they also did a kind of post research where they interviewed everybody that took part in the experiment, and they came up with findings that showed that no one was traumatized. My interpretation of this is when he says no one was traumatized, and you know, you're trying to tell a story, still trying to keep it within the context of the movie. You're still trying to tell a story about, you know, Nazi Germans shooting Jews and gassing people. And then you come out and say no one was traumatized. You know, they did complain. Some people said, why didn't you tell me the truth? You should have just told me what happened. You should have just told me that it wasn't real. But no one was like came out and said, oh, he went through, he had some kind of psychological. Is there something about us that I feel like we could just do some very hideous things and still be okay. The Nazi Germans, we didn't see anybody traumatized. Everybody was out there defending himself and trying to point fingers and saying, yo, Hitler made me do it. It was the Nazi party that made me do it. And try to shift the responsibility, but people died.
I think, well, from how I see it, I think when you, like you said, the emotional state, when you're in a strong emotional state, emotions are the strongest drivers of action. Anyway, so when you're in a strong emotional state and you perform an action, when that emotion wears off, it takes a lot for someone to feel guilt because it was the emotion that was in control at the moment. If I take, for example, in sports, you know, maybe you're losing a game or you're boxing or you're, for example, let me use physical sports like boxing or UFC. You know, in the UFC, you are basically trying to hurt someone so bad that they can't fight back. You know that this is someone that hasn't done anything to you, but you're willing to do it and go through the process, you know, hurt the person, choke the person out, punch the person in the head, the person is bleeding, you keep hitting the same spot at the same time. You do it because there's an emotion that's behind, that's driving you to go through that action. You know, like this is now a kill or be killed situation. All logic is out the window. After the fight, you see that most participants end up hugging and nobody feels bad that, oh man, I just broke this guy's leg or this guy's eyes. Is this guy go to hospital for 6 months? You don't see that emotion. You see elation. You see people hugging and say, that was a good fight and all those things. And it just goes to show that, as Stanley said, the emotion is the most important thing.
So at that moment, they are willing to suspend their emotions. Like
they are willing to suspend their emotions. Hitler used the emotion of, we are the Aryan race. We are more superior to these people. The Jews have come here. They've taken all our jobs. Yada, yada, yada. And he got people to carry out actions that ordinary they wouldn't have. They were living side by side with these people. I mean, even in some other context, you know, if you come down to Africa, we go to soil like Rwanda, where the Hutus and the Tutsis had, 2 million people died in genocide. These are people that were neighbors, brothers, cousins, living side by side. But when the emotion of, oh, we are superior, or oh, we are under attack, or oh, these people are taking our limited resources, comes into play, people end up suspending all forms of reason. And it's interesting because it has been happening time and time and time over again. It happened during the Crusades. It happened way before that. So, you know, it's the experiment, from how I look at it, it was something that was actually needed to be done because it's something that we need to find out. Why do people suspend, you know, reason when it comes to doing some things that don't make sense?
We do have the capacity. When you talk about emotional intelligence, most especially now, we're looking at someone to become self-aware. And in that being self-aware, you need to be able to be critical about yourself, you know, and be objective with a lot of things on the table. It's like everything on the table. You need to be able to feel and understand reality. Now, you could be delusional, or you could, if you're delusional, it means you can't reason properly. But if you can reason properly and you're also self-critical, you could actually look at your actions and feel a remorse because you know you've done very wrong in this situation. Now, a lot of people don't have the act or the ability to be self-critical. And every time they try to justify their position, and that is very bad, and you can't grow. So if you don't have that ability to be self-aware, self-critical of yourself, and you can be a victim of groupthink. And groupthink is also another aspect where if you're not careful, it can happen to anybody. And that is another aspect where we're now bringing our way of thinking, because you think, your thinking affects your emotions affects your behavior. And it's your thinking that can control your emotions. When your thinking is suspended, then you are emotionally hijacked. And that's how it works. So yeah, you see, okay. And that is when you see people moving like headless chicken and they're angry and they can be destructive at that moment because they can't reason. There's the link that links the amygdala to the prefrontal cortex. That place is severe temporarily, and you can't pass information to reason. And one way you can do that is through breathing and some other techniques, just to come into that realization where you are at that moment, to tell yourself, am I doing the right thing? A lot of people who are Nazi Germans, who were under that, oh yes, we are this. But when they say, those who are high in emotional intelligence, probably then, they probably don't know what it is, didn't carry out certain orders. some of them knew that this is not right, and they found, they know it was risk to them, to their life, but they had to escape. But so you see people who can still carry out these orders, and you see those who feel, no, this is not right, I can't do this. And there are people that made decisions and they saved lives as well. So it's like the individual now, his ability to reason and his ability to know how this emotion is happening within him. So we all have these capabilities, but the experiment did show that we were very low on it in this area for a long time. Now there's a lot of awareness on emotional intelligence being a leadership skill, and a lot of this happening now because of a lot of information that has grown from that time to now.
Okay, when we come back, we are going to talk a little more about the shock experiments and also link it to other experiments that were depicted in this particular film and try to see how we can bring it all together.
It's been 45 years since the Milgram experiment took place, but would people behave any differently today? Up with Dr. Jerry Berger, a social psychologist at Santa Clara University in California.
People have often asked this question about, would we find these kinds of results today? And some people try to dismiss the Milgram findings by saying, that's something that happened back in the 60s. People aren't like that anymore.
90 volts.
At 105 volts, he's clearly uneasy.
I got a little moist on my forehead there. I wasn't comfortable. I can't tell you why I listened to him and kept going. I should have just said no.
Usually, obeying authority is good. We obey our parents and we obey our teachers. The problem is, it's fine to obey just authority. It's not fine to obey unjust authority.
Apart from the shock experiments, we see a couple of other experiments that are being depicted in this movie. And, you know, we link to something which I personally found kind of interesting. And it was the one called the Ash Conformity Experiment. And the Ash Conformity Experiment explains to us, it gave me a good understanding why everybody in each culture may say good morning the way they do. If you have to lie down to say good morning, if you have to do some kind of breakdance to say good morning, or you know, bow to shake somebody's hand like they do in some Asian countries, it kind of like gave me a good idea of what is there. And so the Ash Conformity Experiment. Onyeka, you want to give a brief summary of that experiment?
Well, the Ash Conformity Experiment was basically an experiment where Solomon Asch, a professor at that time in psychology, did an experiment to see how people respond to a situation they probably knew to be false, but because they weren't the ones, you know, the only ones responding, they responded the way others responded. It was, and the one of the experiments that he used, the initial one he used was the experiment of a series of lines, the line experiments. And the line experiment was this, where he will hold up a piece of paper with a certain length of a line on it, and another piece of paper that had, you know, different lengths of lines on the paper. And each respondent was told to explain or to point out which lines were the same ones. And when he did the experiments, it turned out in some cases, some people will see lines, will respond to how other people responded, even when they knew that the answers were false. You know, most of the times when these experiments were done, there were like four actors and only one person, one true subject. And usually the true subject was placed like fourth in line. So he will respond after the first three have responded. And it turned out that in some situations, the first three will obviously say something is false, but they will all pick the same thing. And the fourth person will just go along with it because he wanted to conform, hence the name, the conformity experiments. Right. And it was quite interesting to see. Even though the results weren't so, there weren't so many people that acted that way, there were still a good number of people, a significant amount of people did that. And it was something that led, it was even what led to the Milgram experiments that happened after, because Milgram was a student of Solomon Asch himself.
Yeah.
So it was one of the first experiments that started showing the link between group behavior and, you know, the cascade effect and the bad wagon effect. And it was a pace setter at this time. It was one of the first experiments that happened in that way.
A lot of people use this a lot in terms of advertisers, marketers, politicians. They tap into this group thing. And that's actually been the trump card for most of them. So most of the times we are unconscious about how we do certain things. And we get into this unconscious mode and we just see ourselves behaving like sheep. When they say you behave like a sheep, let me give you an example. If you put a rope between two trees and you have some sheep around you and you start instructing the sheep maybe by telling them to move and they have the first one jumps, the second one jumps. If you remove the rope, the third one will still jump. The fourth one and all of them will jump. Of course, the rope is not there, but they all jump. And we tend to get into this unconscious mode. And that mode is also a very dangerous one, where we make decisions without really evaluating our decisions properly. So it's just like the same thing that happened about getting into the elevator. You see everybody facing their back and you just unconsciously start facing. No.
That is the strongest conformity experiment I've ever seen.
Yes, or the other people looking up. They were looking up and everybody was passing and they say looking up and like, what's there? We've seen this happen. And most of us remembered very well the Keja bomb blast that happened.
Yeah.
Most people died because they followed the group thing. They didn't sit down to ask what is going on here. And unconsciously, they all ran to their graves. You know, so the way to avert this kind of group thinking is to also bring what we call critical thinking. It's important. The essence of critical thinking is like a tool to avoid all these unconscious biases that we have, heuristics that we feel, and our ability to make effective and better decisions for ourselves. We sometimes can get fooled by a lot of things happening around. And that's why we need to apply this tool. So if you are a critical thinker, once you see this, the first thing is to analyze what's going on here, you know, before you start evaluating your actions. But there are a lot of people that don't do this. They just go with the flow, you know, and when you go with the flow, that's what happens to you. You conform unconsciously to this kind of...
So when the scientists carry out all these experiments, one of the things that I kind of find fascinating, Solomon Ash just used something as basic as a line. You saw it with your own eyes. What I mean is that, and I am saying you saw, you know, it's a bunch of lines. It's scary. You know, sometimes, you know, I don't know, maybe there's a way I process this thing sometimes. So, you know, I came across this experiment actually before I saw this film. And even when I read about it, I was as fascinated as I was when I saw it. Because if you can deny what your eyes can see, I don't know how you can manage what you are told. And you know, sometimes when Stanley, some, you know, I think we've talked about, you know, the reptilian brain and the way we just get swallowed by emotion. Because when you talk about emotional intelligence sometimes, I've always asked, how does the person wake up to an emotional intelligence when it appears that these experiments insinuate that he is incapacitated when he is placed in a group? Because I'm saying that the line is shorter. The line is shorter. You see it with your eyes. you see where I'm coming from, Onyeka.
To bring some brevity into the situation, there's this popular video that came out in Nigeria where a boy was trying to tell his mom not to beat him up, and he kept saying, be calming down, mommy, be calming down. You know, I think a lot of times, in a lot of situations, what needs to happen is for people to calm down and process the information ahead of them.
In a group situation.
You know, we see it when... especially in a group situation, we see it where a thief is caught in a market and people are carrying petrol and tires to pour over the person and burn the person. There are a lot of people that wouldn't kill a mosquito if they had a choice, but they'll see another human being about to be burnt for something as simple as an orange or maybe a phone being stolen. And nobody will process the situation and say, no, there's a better way to handle this. This person should be handed over to the authorities. They'll be there. Some might even bring out their phones and video the process and watch another person get killed. Jungle justice will happen. But it happened because people didn't calm down in that process. You know, calm down is using a very simplistic term. But what they need to do is process the information ahead of them and make the right choice. As Stanley said, you can't make that choice if you don't have the ability to think critically. And I think that's a function of education. It's why in certain places, they try and ensure that the whole populace is literate enough to make rational decisions. Because in key things like politics and election cycles, when people can't think critically, they end up being pulled by emotions and you end up having people make bad choices.
I totally agree that critical thinking. I agree that, yes, if we all, you know, have this ability to think. But these experiments, like especially the one of Solomon Ash, am I missing something, or is what he purports is that we are incapacitated once dropped and miss a group, that your critical thinking will not even apply? Because I have seen very educated people, very, you know, talking about, you know, flying dragonish kind of things that just does not make some kind of sense, because maybe they belong to some kind of group or something that asserts these kind of beliefs.
That's why we are talking about bringing critical thinking in the educational space, you know, so that children will know how to think critically and be able to know how to make the right decisions. Now, if you look at Professor Ash's experiment, you can also see that in peer pressure, when you're young and you have a friend, there are a lot of things we did because our friends, they do it, and everybody did it. You know, you couldn't just say, but they would say sometimes, they would say, do you say, no, I'm not doing it because my mama or my papa told me not to do it. So you then bring in some reason, because then you probably realize the consequences of your action if this gets your parents. And you see some of us pull back and say, no, do this. Peer pressure is a very, very, very strong bond. And that can also affect people. And people that have a sense of shared identity, they can also have this pressure to conform to that identity they share. But then that is where, like we say, critical thinking comes in. It's a tool we use. Because all of us are victim to this, our brain, that can be very deceptive to even us. So you need to use it to protect yourself and defend yourself to make the right decision. Let me add to the research on decision making, which was done by Daniel Kahneman on his groundbreaking book, which was Thinking Fast and Slow. And just to summarize it, when you think, he said that we have two systems within us, one that thinks fast and the other one that thinks slow. When you think fast, that's when you act on impulses and things happen. You're not aware and you could be affected by a lot of things like your biases. You could be affected by your belief system, your values. All these things can happen and quickly you can make those smart decisions. But when you think slow, you do not take time to analyze a lot of varieties and alternatives. Then you start to narrow down to make what the right decision is. Or you try to look at, okay, am I looking at the holistic aspect of it? And you're talking about systems thinking. So you start to bring in those kind of thinking, because our thinking is what affects the feeling. When you have that emotional hijack, there's a dislodge between how you reason. You can't reason at that time. So you've been hijacked. And until you, like Onyeka said, you have to calm down. If calming down is to allow information to start flowing back to your prefrontal cortex, the seat of the decision-making process. So understanding the anatomy of the brain is also important. I'll be talking in an event very soon, which is online, about emotional literacy in the classroom, trying to encourage teachers to be, so teachers have to be emotionally intelligent, to be aware of different children's emotions in the classroom. Children come from different places. They are already affected by emotional stress, maybe a toxic home, or probably they just lost someone, or the mom is sick, or dad is sick, or somebody closes. They come back with these different emotional baggages. And how do you manage that in the classroom? And how do you also teach these children what emotional literacy is, so that they are aware about their emotions? They know how to manage it. And also, that also helped to bring down issues like mental health issues as well. So we need to bring this in from the foundational level. And also, Onyeka also made this contribution to where he said there needs to be that literate. We need to look at how we develop the society. And when you have a lot of illiterate people who can't reason, then that's where you have people like Socrates saying things like, ignorance is the worst evil.
Because
you are ignorant, you don't know. And when you don't know, you are afraid.
But they are always going to be more. That's the issue, is they are always going to be more. And you know, you use a word called hijack. And let me tell you the biggest hijackers. The biggest hijacker is somebody who is, he's trying to run for office. He wants to get elected. He will say the words. And these words have the ability to, you know, trigger certain kinds of emotions, make people react.
It's called public.
So my point is that, you know, and you see this human frailty in terms of, you know, our brain anatomy that functions in this kind of way that may or may not be public knowledge to even some of the perpetrators of, you know, this hijacking, as it may seem to be. As far as I know, we are talking education. Let us start talking about numbers. How many? And I think I've used this analogy with you before, Stanley, where I said something about the issue. I think it was during one election like that we had, and they said, look, the CEO of Glo or CEO of MTN or even the stock exchange and the kole man that comes to take out your trash, it's one vote each. That you were the CEO does not mean your vote counts 3 or 4 times. You may have certain powers to lobby in politics and all that, but your vote is still one vote. So if elections are like a game of numbers, you appeal to people's emotions and all of that. At the end of the day, it appears that it will still be the few people that may be having this conversation of, oh, take a step back, breathe, think about it, relax. You know, and kind of take it. Let's take a little break. And when we come back, we try to push this conversation to the finish line.
What's your choice?
It's A.
You think it's A?
I think so.
Okay, go to A.
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 It's A. Definitely A.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going with A.
Okay.
It's A.
You're going to go with the group?
Yeah.
All right. Great. I want to ask you something. Did your gut at first tell you that the answer was actually C?
Yeah, but everyone was choosing A, so I just felt like I had to pick A too.
You felt the pull of the crowd.
Yeah.
We'll let you in on a little secret. The first 9 people in this line were working for us, and each time we ran the experiment, they were instructed to pick the same wrong answer.
A.
A.
A. It's A.
Seeing all these people choose A left the last person in line who wasn't in on it with a tough decision. To go with their gut or with a group.
You're going to go with the group?
Yeah.
There were a lot of random experiments actually that were carried out in this movie. And we see where Stanley Milgram, you know, he becomes a professor or as associate professor, you know, looking for tenure, and he's dealing with his students. And at the end of the day, he tells them to do random stuff like, you know, go sing in a bus, go and sing in a bus and, you know, and whatever. But, and another one where he tells them to stand and look in the sky and, you know, the typical Lagos look at people starts gathering a crowd at the end of the day. So, but there was one particular one that I feel I found kind of interesting where he asks them to, you know, mail letters and he's able to tie it down to, you know, basically having this idea that it's we are all separated between like 6 major contacts, which I think that was the premise with which, you know, Facebook, the social network, was built on. You know, they have this idea that from where you are, you will know somebody that knows the president within 6 of 7 contacts. But I am trying to figure out what the whole significance is to the whole conformity experiment and the shock experiment.
Just to talk about the experiment. I know both of you, we've had this kind of situation where you've met someone, probably a stranger, and you started talking with this stranger, all to find that you guys have some common affiliations or common people that you know together. And you like, one of the things, expression that will come out, oh, the small world. Right?
I
hope. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was based on this small word hypothesis that made Milgram carry out that experiment, which was called the lost letter experiment. And the essence was to test this small word hypothesis that we are kind of all linked in a way by 6 degrees of separation. And that we have, if you look within it, you have 6, 7, 8, but I think the average is 6 degrees, six people, six nodes.
5.5. But he just called it six.
Yes. So you use rule of the thumb.
Yeah.
So that's what he did. And we've seen the, so the whole essence is that you bring two individuals who don't know themselves from different parts of the world. You can actually find people that are linked to them, intermediaries. So if I want to look at your link to Obama, let me say, I probably will find out that you'll find out six people. So what they did was to do this experiment. Remember, he's an experimenter and a social psychologist. So they need to test this on the field. And they have to use this control group to be able to measure the experiment. So all those things he was doing, having those people behind in the obedience and authority, that knew what was happening was the control group. So now what they did was to send this letter. And the way he did it was to scatter this letter to different places and ask respondents to forward it to this person at this place. And all you need to do was to look at within your social circle, three people that you think you know that should know that person. And when, although the response wasn't too great, because out of about 400 or 500 letters he tried to say that the respondents were at 64. But when they did the mathematical average, they were able to come to that 6. And there's a whole lot of science, because the whole study was to look at social interaction in a social networking group, how we network. And Facebook today have used AI to do a better job of it right now. When you get into Facebook, you import your contacts, that they tell you you must know, you somebody you should know, or people you shouldn't know. And also your mutual friends.
Mutual friendships.
That, yes, all those things have helped. It's all based on this research. They were trying to do, and also we found out that there's even a game called this Kevin Bacon's 6 degrees of separation. That is just within that Hollywood setting. They believe that Kevin Bacon has been strategically been in certain kind of movie that one way or the other, if you're a Hollywood player or someone that has been in that Hollywood community, you should have know 6 people that will take you to Kevin Bacon. So it's just trying to look at how we are all connected. And that in as much that we stay in a very large expanse geographical space, still we are just very close to each other in terms of this very small world.
So I just think that in terms of, like, you know, the whole letters thing, I kind of saw two things there, where he would send his, you know, have, you know, the one he talked about sending white letters to black neighborhoods, black letters to white neighborhoods, and you know, so people won't mail them. People won't mail people from the white neighborhoods.
Definitely,
there is so much to unpack. It's unbelievable. Like,
of course, it will happen because you see, especially in that era of sort of divisiveness, then racial divisiveness, then so a lot of people will feel, why are you by getting a letter? I should address a letter. Maybe I'm a black man to a white guy.
Yeah.
So you saw the other guy. So what kind of
he tore it in that movie? He picked up that thing from the windshield.
And even Stanley Milgram said he said that because it was somewhat of a very good idea. He also acknowledged the shortcomings of the research. But it was a very good one in terms of trying to look at social connectivity, in terms of how we are close to people. So how does it relate to the conformity aspect is that you can actually see it in the sense that if you're also trying to perpetrate some kind of evil or something to someone, you should also realize too that you are six, that there might be 2 people that you guys have mutual relationship with.
Right.
There could be 3 people that you might have mutual relationship with. So one way or the other, we're all interconnected.
Okay, so that whole idea of I'm doing this thing to this person, I think I don't know him, but he may be my brother's cousin, friends, sisters, brothers, and something like that.
Very true.
So it's a small world. That's why I say it's a small world. So you never, like you said, don't throw stones in the market square. You never know when it's going to hit. I guess we should just be a bit more careful.
So, just in terms of closing, Onyeka, what kind of people do you think will watch this movie? I would recommend it though.
But... someone like me, these are the sorts of movies that, you know, you pull out at certain kind of situations. Have you watched this movie? So that you can have a certain kind of discussion, because just the regular policeman down and out, they killed his wife, he wants to fight who killed his wife movie, it's not really what appeals to me. Things like this that show, because it can, as Stanley said, Facebook has taken some of the results from this thing to a whole nother level. You know, sometimes I'm scrolling through my Facebook and I'm seeing a suggestion of a face I know, but, you know, I don't want to know. But because I know someone that I knows the person, Facebook is now popping up, showing me the person's face. I say, you should know this person. Add this person up. And I'm like, no, I don't want to add this person up. You know, it does that. You see it on Instagram and all these connected, you know, social media apps and stuff, they suggest things you want. You know, if you go on Instagram and you like pictures of food, after a while you start getting pictures of food appearing all over your page. Yeah. And you start saying, okay, this is what this is all about. So all these things are things that have real life applications. You know, we watch the movie and, you know, it's like, oh, the horror of this. But I can tell you, there's one business person, someone that watched that movie, I was like, aha, this is how we're going to market this product. And before you know something, people are rushing the product and they don't know why they're rushing the product, even though it seems a bit distasteful or something. I remember when this game came out, Mortal Kombat came out in the 90s, and parents were all shocked that, oh, there's so much blood, there's so much gore, but the game is still standing.
Not anymore. Last time I've been a
fighter. You know, it lasted a long while, you know, so it just shows that people are willing to do certain things, no matter the shock it might seem to other people. And there's a reasoning behind all this. And experiments like this show us why. So personally, on a personal level, this sort of movie is the much watched for someone like me. Yeah. I can't miss it.
Stanley, what's your final word so we just know what you think about this movie?
Yes, it's a highly cerebral movie that exposes a lot and makes us become aware of certain things that probably happen around us, especially in our society, and also among us ourselves, to have that critical inward reflection of ourselves, knowing that we too can make such kind of mistakes and find our best to protect ourselves. Like, for example, like we mentioned, things like emotional intelligence. Let us see how to constantly get good at it. Emotional intelligence is not an end point. It's a journey you embark on to constantly get better. And it's like a degree. You grow in degrees of proficiency, your ability to use them. And also critical thinking. There are all kinds of skills that are really required today in the 21st century. If you look at the top 10 skills, they are there. It's one of the things leaders and people need to get now. They are hot cake everywhere. So this music kind of affirmed that these skills are really needed. And so it's a very high cerebral movie, one I would recommend to my classes during my lectures so that people can go watch this movie. So it's thumbs up for it. And it's a movie that can be life transforming if you take time to understand what this movie is all about and where it's supposed to go to. And also to appreciate a lot of things about psychology, how they help us to unravel and untangle a lot of mysteries we feel regarding this emotion and how we sometimes get unconsciously. We've seen this happen in that we're talking about systemic racism and things like this. These are becoming issues. And we're talking about critical race theory in America. And there are people who are not willing to, there's this divisive argument about, you know, whether we should allow it, we should not allow it. It's all coming to, this movie will definitely bring a lot of understanding to a lot of people if they can calm down and watch it. So I recommend it. Very good. Very good.
All right. For me, the movie just made me understand a little more about ourselves, and it makes me just tell myself, look, I have to watch myself. I have to know what exactly are my choices. What exactly am I, you know, why am I doing what I do? Am I making the right decisions, or am I going to take responsibility for these decisions, or am I just going to bequeath this responsibility to somebody else? And I just use a workplace as an example, like, you know, where you work, whether you do what you do, it's good or bad or business decisions. You just say, hey, heck, I just work here. And on that note, I think we have come to the end of another episode of Real Talk Extra. Thank you for listening, and we will see you at the next reel.
Love and light.
Have a good one.
Nice one.
Thank you for listening to Real Talk Extra. That's R-E-E-L Talk Extra. Do us a solid and follow us everywhere that you listen to your podcast. We love feedback, so you can send us an email at podcast@realtalkextra.com, or you can send us a WhatsApp message, and the number is +1 919 283 6448. That's WhatsApp only. Thanks once again for spending this time with us, and we will see you at the next reel.